This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 11 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. In today's episode, we have Riven Caldara and Joshua Tempany to talk about their book, Real Service. Here's our hosts, Woody and the Beast.
Thank you, Max. And here we go for another round of the kinky world of the Kinky Cast. Hey, Beast, what do you know tonight?
I know that the weather's warming up and the sap is rising. At least my sap is.
Oh, that's sappy.
I knew I set you up for that one. Woody, with us tonight, we have the lovely Chrissy. We'll remember her from an episode or two back when she was talking about the slave mentality. And today she's joining us with a remote interview of a prominent author in this area. Chrissy?
Thank you, Beast. Tonight, we have the great pleasure of speaking with Riven Caldara and his slave, Joshua Tenpenny. For those who don't know who our guests are, Riven Caldara is a queer, female-to-male, transgendered, intersexual shaman. He's the author or editor of 34 books, including Dark Moon Rising, Pagan BDSM and the Ordeal Path, Dear Riven and Joshua, Questions and Answers about Master-Slave Relationships, and Power Circuits, Polyamory, and Power Dynamic. He and his slave boy Joshua have been teaching and presenting workshops regularly for many years to the BDSM, neo-pagan, sex and spirituality, transgender, and other communities. Joshua Tenpenny is Raven's boy and his devoted assistant, partner, and slave for life. He is a massage therapist, shiatsu practitioner, and yoga teacher. He's the author of Real Service and the creator of The Service Notebook. He is polymorphously perverse and finds spiritual fulfillment through any kind of worthy service. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
Riven, you have written many, many interesting books. I think that I've read 10 of them at least, and currently I'm reading 2. I always have something of yours somewhere in the house that I'm reading. I'd like to speak with you and with Joshua tonight about the book that you've produced called A Real Service. And this is the topic that I believe is often misunderstood. Recently, I gave a presentation to our local mass chapter using this book as a focal point, and the attendees seemed to enjoy it very much. Many people were taking notes, even people that considered themselves to be very well-versed in the scene. Your book opens by discussing the realization that so many who wish to serve approach the subject as a fantasy or a role-playing game. And of course, this is a setup for failure, and this is the launching point for the four rules of service that Joshua describes so well. Would you care to talk about this a little bit?
Sure. Well, let's see. Rule one of Josh's rules of service, and they're Joshua's. He put them together. Rule one is, if the master doesn't want it, it's not service. And this is a tough one, because I think that every summer slave out there, especially the really service-oriented ones, have this whole mental fantasy of all the things, all the services that they would like to give their dominant or their master. And maybe the dominant or master looks at them and says, "What? Are you kidding?" But really, if the master doesn't want it, it's not service. They might humor you, but it's still not service.
That kind of reminds me of the situation of the naked submissive kneeling at the door when master comes home every day from work. Really, how long is that going to last? It's a hot fantasy, but in reality, when master would really rather have a ham sandwich and a cold beer, you know, it's a different story entirely. The next rule that was mentioned is contempt has no place in service. And what do you mean by contempt has no place in service?
Well, what we mean by that is that so often we see service dynamics portrayed where the person on top is, you know, thinks of the person serving them not just as someone who is sort of lower in social rank, but someone who is like inherently valueless or of negligible value. And on the other side, we also see people who are in service positions who are bitter and resentful of the people that they're serving.
Because our society is really screwed up about service and does not value it, does not value service personnel properly. And let me tell you, that's stupid, because a good support staff, there is nothing like a good support staff. But there's this contempt that goes both ways, because the positions are seen as socially really undesirable. And people look at the person who's, you know, serving you your fries and they say, can't you do any better than that? And we really need to change our social outlook towards service if we want to be able to get rid of contempt on each side. But let me tell you, the people who are in dom-sub or master-slave relationships who are doing this mindfully, you got no excuse on either side. There needs to be mutual respect.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that, certainly. And again, that goes back to the fantasy role play. You do as I say because I say so, and there's no thought behind it about the service and the type of service and the implementation of that service.
Well, I think there's also a long cultural loading of the word master and the word slave.
Oh, yeah.
Going back to historic periods where that word often had a very negative connotation, literally leading to a war that nearly ripped the country apart. Before that, the word master had great meaning as it applied to somebody that had mastered a craft. But I think that was obliterated during the American Civil War, in our culture at least, and the word master took on a very negative connotation, I believe.
The whole concept of service, at least in modern society, has a negative load to it in a lot of respects. As you mentioned, you know, the person who's serving your fries, you know, that they're doing a service, they're doing a job, and they should be respected for that. Contempt and disrespect on either side of the slash is recipe for disaster, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of in the porn, there's a lot of, oh, you're a worthless worm. In reality, you don't want your servant to be a worthless worm. You want them to be a competent person.
Yes, absolutely.
That is, if the relationship extends beyond the 20 minutes that it took to shoot the porn clip.
You also mentioned that the third rule that you created, which is a great rule, a good servant wants their master to be right. Yes, 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 always.
That one was very hard for me because I like being right. I am not, while I am happy being in a subordinate role, if I think I'm right about something, I think I'm right. So when I would get into situations where I would be in a situation and Raven would think that the one thing was the best way to go about it, and I would try to respectfully offer an alternate suggestion, I could get the hang of offering the suggestion respectfully, but what it took me a long time to get the hang of is then if he decided not to take my advice and went with his original plan and it went badly, for me not to be like, ha-ha, you know, should have taken my advice. So for me to be in that position of saying that when he's proven wrong, that I feel good about the situation, that was a very corrosive place for me to be in.
Yeah, I can appreciate that totally. From my point of view, definitely it's a very difficult place to be in. I think that ego has a lot to do with that.
Yeah, I think that masters and mistresses are not always right. We are not always, we make mistakes. But the ideal isn't that the sub or slave is sitting there pretending that you're right when you're not. It's that they want, you as a sub or slave should want them to be right, should hope that they're going to be right, should hope that even when you think it's wrong, that they will find a way to convince you. And if they do turn out to be wrong, that you stomp on any, oh boy, well, I was right, I told you so, because that really undermines the emotions of the dynamic. It should be, well, these things happen, let's move on.
But that's not healthy in any relationship.
Mm-hmm. The position that I try to come at it from is sort of like, well, your plan seems pretty messed up, sir, and I can't imagine how that's possibly going to work. However, I hope that it does. I want to see your plan work out, and if there's any way that I can help that plan, even though I think it's a bad plan, if there's any way I can help that plan turn out well, I want to be able to do that.
You rock, Joshua. That's excellent. I support you.
I think, Chrissy, you missed the rule, a bad attitude.
I think that hooks into what we just talked about. A bad attitude is corrosive to service. I just say real quick, when we first started out, I said, do what I tell you. I expect complete obedience. But if you want to grumble about it while you're doing it, I really don't care. And this, of course, came out of raising, you know, a teenager. That, you know, if they do it at all, even while bitching loudly, you're happy. And at first I was just like, just get it done. But then later, Josh came to me and said, you know, when I do it, bitching in my head
it really undermines my feelings of being satisfied in your service. And so I would like it if you would require me to try to have a good attitude about this. And so we found various ways of things he can say to himself, things he can focus on to help him get a better attitude. And I think that's one of the hardest things that an S-type can do, and also one of the most important.
I'm thinking about that. I agree with you, and I'm thinking of situations that I found myself in where attitude was definitely corrosive. Sometimes it's very difficult to snap out of it. It's very difficult. You kind of have to put yourself in a zen place sometimes. Just go with it.
And I'm not the best at that. I mean, I am not a super cheerful, always eager to please kind of person. We've got a second boy in our service right now, Brandon, and he is just this little ray of sunshine. I don't know how he does it, but he is always, like, right there, big smile on his face, ready to do whatever is required. And I'm like, this again, damn it. And I really have to work to get a good attitude about things. So it's been really inspiring for me to have someone else around who just comes to that so naturally. And it can be a discipline, getting a good attitude about stuff.
Yes, it is. You're right. A discipline. That's a great observation. Yes. I tend to be lately a little undisciplined, as a matter of fact. But moving on. I really like the fourth rule that you created, the one that a good servant wants their master to be right. I really find that interesting. I think that has the potential to be the most psychologically difficult. I just think that it's really hard for people to get their head around that. I want to thank you for your explanation and your comments on that. Now, the next section talks about motivations for service. It describes three types of motivations: transactional service, devotional service, and positional service. And I always think of a transactional service as something for something, pretty straightforward and direct.
I will get you that drink because you're going to beat me later.
Exactly, and that's okay. You know, that'll work. And devotional service, that's a really heavy basis where I come from.
I serve you because I love you.
Yes, and the third would be positional service, and that would be more of a ranking situation.
I serve because it's who I am. I would do it anyway.
Yes.
Once the identity is tied into serving. And there are positive and negative things about all of them, and I think in a very well-rounded service relationship, especially one where you've got a close relationship, you're using all three.
Yeah, I think you have to use all three. I think they intersect. Yeah. They support each other and lean on each other. You can't.
Yes, because there are days when you'll wake up and you don't love the person, or you'll have to go do something for someone else. There's been some people will ask, like, you know, has your master ever lent you out? And I'm like, well, yes, but never for anything fun. You know, he's lent me out to help people move and drive them places. And I don't necessarily like the people that he lends me out to. I mean, some of them are great, but some of them it's like, oh, that one again. Jeez.
You move four times in 2 years.
Fall back and sort of like, it's my role to assist you. Or that I'm doing this for this person because they're going to be giving us something in exchange. I think of the day when any one of them doesn't work, you have the other two to back you up.
Yeah, that's a great way to think of it. Exactly.
So this devotional thing is partially fed, again, by these fantasies where you're going to be loned out for the hot, torrid sex with these wonderful people that are going to fulfill all your fantasies. And the reality in most relationships are far different for most of us.
I disagree. I don't think that's the case at all. I think devotional service is you do something for the person that you're devoted to. It's not for hot. No.
I totally agree about devotional service being a wonderful thing. It's we're talking about being loaned out.
Oh, being loaned out. Well, that goes into the fantasy. That's hot.
Back to the fantasy stuff again.
Well, yeah, those are hot fantasies. And really, how often does that actually really happen? And if it does, how often does it actually work out? The hot fantasy. Mm-hmm. You continue through your book and you talk about describing styles of service as reactive service and proactive service. What's the difference between the two, and why are they important?
Well, reactive service is do what I say, just what I say, only what I say. Proactive service is do what I want. Do what you already know I want because you've been trained to know that, and you do it without me having to tell you.
So that would fall into anticipatory service.
I think anticipatory service is kind of the far end of proactive service. It's like if I'm going to stand over you and say, okay, sweep this floor, okay, do those dishes, or whatever, that's reactive service. If you have a chore list, and I'm leaving for the day, and you will get those chores done because you know what to do, and I come home and it's all done, That's proactive service. And yeah, the far end of that is anticipatory, where you know the person so well that you can make leaps of judgment to figure out what they're gonna want. And I think masters either love or hate anticipatory service, and a lot of the ones who hate it, it's because they've never had it done well.
Yes, I can understand poorly done anticipatory service puts you in a position of having to either correct someone for something they really put great consideration in their mind into performing, mm-hmm. and that's an awkward situation in a relationship. Always.
Yeah, it is difficult. One of the things that Raven had to make real clear with me is that if he's going to allow me to do anticipatory service, I like being able to do that. I really do. So if he's going to allow me that freedom to figure out ways to serve him, I need to promise him that if he doesn't like it, I'll be cool with that. I mean, I might be a little disappointed, but I need to really be in control of my emotions in that situation. Not take it personally, and not put him in a position where he feels obligated to like it or go along with it. I have a rough rule that if I spend less than $20 or less than 20 minutes on it, go for it. Don't worry about it. If it gets beyond that point, then I need to start checking in with him as to what exactly his priorities are in the situation.
And I actually love anticipatory service when it's done right, and Josh is very good at it. And for all that, yeah, I love obedience, and I love do this, and hearing yes, sir, even better is hearing it's already done. That's great.
I am reminded of my three favorite words: communication, communication, communication.
Yeah, I mean, you don't get to proactive service overnight. It takes quite a long time of training, and you don't get to anticipatory service for quite a long time of waiting and training and looking and observing the master or dominant, you know, for months or even years. This is something that really goes slow, and I think people want to do it overnight, and it's not fast, it's slow. It also is that some masters are fussier than others. You know, some masters are pretty easygoing, and like, if you're cooking for them, whatever you cook, is it edible, I'll eat it, right? And some masters are like, this is exactly the way I want a bacon sandwich made. No, you've put too many slices of bacon on my sandwich, you know? And they really want things exactly one way. Now, I kind of like a real exacting protocol for how things should be done, and Raven does not like that at all. Any reasonable implementation of an order that he gives, he is generally pretty happy with.
That sounds really great. I'm happy for you both, or I'm happy for all of you. I know you have a very large family. I'm thinking, as you're talking tonight about service and understanding that you live together, you all share a house, and I'm wondering, how difficult is it for people that don't share a house to engage in types of service? And I'm not talking about long distance relationships necessarily. I'm talking about that just, you know, live in the same city but different houses. And I know several people that are involved in polyamorous relationships that are service oriented. What are some of the challenges here?
I think it's about imagination. What can you come up with? The team should sit down and discuss what can be done and figure out ways in which that they can serve. There's the when I'm not home service, which could be looking things up on the internet for you, or in the first 11 months of our relationship, we lived apart and saw each other only every other weekend, and Josh built all my websites. And heck, if you're in the same city, you can come over and clean my house. We've had our second boy, Brandon, for 2 years, and the first year he didn't live with us. He would come out for a couple of days a week and do stuff for me. So I think it's only limited by your imagination.
The other thing, though, that I like to emphasize is that, again, sort of going back to if the master doesn't want it, it's not service. I have talked to a lot of MS couples where they don't get to spend a whole lot of time with each other, and when the S-type comes over, they're like, oh my God, I want to clean everything, I want to fold all your stuff and do all this housework, and the master's like, no, chill the fuck out, you know? I mean, don't worry about the housework. Spend some time with me. And that can be really very hard for a goal-oriented, service-oriented S-type to get their head around that for right now, the best service they can provide is companionship.
Companionship can be a wonderful service.
In fact, it's a particular hat or role that we refer to that Josh, you have to do the charming companion job.
Yeah, I like that. I agree with you. I think and that goes again, like you said, to the first rule. If the master doesn't want it, it isn't service.
And it doesn't matter if their house is a wreck. That was really hard for me. You know, like if Raven kept his house immaculate and I came by and there was nothing to do except companionship, that would be pretty easy for me. But to come by and be like, man, this place could use some picking up, actually. How about I get on that for you? And he's like, no, don't worry about it. That's not my priority today.
I don't understand exactly what you're saying. Master won't let me clean his car. And I'm a clean freak with cars. I'm a clean freak. And his attitude is, one day. And please, may I clean your car? No. Please, may I clean your car? No. You're a sadist.
I'm sure he has his reasons.
Yes.
My philosophy is everything's in a place where I put it, and I know where it is.
Right.
Simple enough. Talking about styles of dominance, you mentioned that the style of dominance plays a big role and recognizing there is a continuum, identifying parental and celebrity styles of dominance. I've never heard the term parental or celebrity style of dominance used before.
I haven't made those up. Yeah, I created those because it's about there's two types, so there's a spectrum. On one end, you've got what I refer to as parental dominance, which has nothing to do with age play. It has the high control dynamic. It's lots of reactive service. It's the dominant is making all the decisions, and the sub's job is just to do what they're told, and they have a great deal of authority in those areas. It's sort of like the way a parent would over a child. You know, I'm gonna tell you what to wear. I'm gonna tell you what to eat. That kind of thing. And then the other end of the spectrum is the celebrity. And if you think of like Batman and his butler Alfred, you know, the S-type's job is to clear the way, get the obstacles out of the path, and just make things comfortable. And it's a lot of high proactive service. And the example that I love to use, and I think I put in the book, is if you have two couples walk into a restaurant, and one's got a parental dominant, and the other one's got a celebrity dominant, and the parental dominant, the two of them arrive, they come in, the parental dominant drove because the sub doesn't need to drive,
mm-hmm.
and the sub doesn't even carry a wallet because the parental dominant has all the money, and they sit down and the dominant orders for both of them because the dominant knows what's good for the sub, and when they're done, the dominant decides they're done, pays the bill, and they leave. But the celebrity dominant, the sub drives because they're the chauffeur. And they go in first and grab a table by the window, and while the dominant is making a phone call, and they order for the dominant, for themselves and the dominant, because they know what the dominant likes, and they want to have it all ready when they walk in. And then the dominant gets to come in, sit down, eat their meal, and when they're done, they get up and walk off, and the sub pays and then drives them home. So one is very much all about reactive service and control, and the other is all about proactive service and anticipatory service to a certain extent, just being the perfect assistant. So, and I tend to be on the celebrity end, but sometimes I will slide to the other side when something's going on. During sex, I often slide to the other side. When Josh is sick, I slide to the other side, this sort of thing. And most people have one end that they're really, that really calls to them, and a lot of the poor fit that we see when couples get together is you've got a dominant who wants to be on one end, and you've got a sub that wants to be on the other end. And they look at each other and they say, what's wrong with you? You're not a real dominant or sub. And what's really going on is that they're on different ends of the spectrum and they're just a poor fit.
That makes a great deal of sense. Absolutely.
I had never heard that before. And now it makes it just kind of clicked. I read the book, but obviously I skipped a page somewhere in there. But that could explain the problem in many DS relationships for poor fit is just the styles just aren't mm-hmm. the same.
And, you know, we do a lot of categorizing of things. That's sort of our thing. We like to sort of describe different ways of doing things and different ways to come at a situation. And not to sort of label people or to sort of, you know, rank different, you know, this is better than that, but just because we do see a lot of situations where people look at some, you know, they're in a relationship with a dominant and they say, oh, well, you know, you just want to tell me what to, you just want to, me to clean up after you. You don't want to actually master me. You're expecting me to master myself. You know, and I'm like, well, okay, I realize that for you, that's a terrible, that is a terrible dominant, but someone else might really like that. Someone else might like not being micromanaged.
And I think there's also a lot of you're doing it wrong that floats around this demographic. And part of why we like to describe different styles is so we can say, no, 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 people are not doing it wrong. They're doing it differently.
Well, some people are doing it wrong, but...
That's a loaded statement.
Well, no, for us, really, doing it wrong means doing it in a way that's not fulfilling to the people involved. You know, is what you're doing working out for the both of you? Great.
And if it doesn't look anything like what we do, we'd like to hear about it so that we can talk about it. We can describe it to other people.
And in fact, I got to say, a lot of the when we look at certain things or we describe certain things, we say, well, this is the wrong way to do it. Mostly what we're saying is that usually goes badly. We've seen that go badly so many times that if things are going badly and you're doing that, try not doing that and see if it improves things.
But on the other hand, there's just a lot of people out there who say, oh, yeah, I want to be like a master or a slave, but they don't have the language to think through what it is they really want, what they want that to look like.
Yeah, I agree with you there. That's why I promote your books so heavily. They're wonderful tools, great resources.
You know, we can all look around at people we know and see mismatches in the parental or the celebrity type dominance, but I can also see that there's a mismatch of celebrity versus parental type slaves. And what's really odd is when you see two celebrities sitting together, one slave and mm-hmm. one master.
You never know.
And, you know, and I just say that Rave and I were not the best fit with regard to this sort of thing. I mean, in that I liked a much more micromanaging kind of style. I really expected a lot more hands-on control from him. And he realized after doing this for a while that that was just not what he was interested in.
And everyone adapted. One thing that I liked in the book was the section that you wrote about, Raven. So you wrote about the annoyance factor. And that was your section that you devoted to the book. Would you like to talk about the annoyance
sure.
factor?
Sure. When we got together, we had all these great ideas about how we were going to do a master-slave relationship. And many of them were drawn, some of them were drawn from porn, some of them were drawn from Leather Protocol and things like that. And we would try them with, okay, you're going to do this, and you're going to do this, and you're going to do this, and you're going to do this. And when I come home, you're going to do this. And what would happen was, it would work for like a couple of weeks, but I would forget to check up on him. And this is a problem we often see. I think a lot of people in the early stages of a power dynamic have this problem. It would slip my mind because I really wasn't as invested as I would have liked to have been in those behaviors. And he would forget to do them, and I would forget to check, and then he would get upset at me and say, don't you care?
Oh, I so relate.
And it would just go badly from there. I think you probably have seen this dance before. And finally had to do is we sat down after like a year and a half of just trying this and having it fail again and again.
And a lot of hard feelings on both sides, I got to say.
We sat down and we threw everything out. I looked at the things that I'd asked him to do that I never failed in noticing when he didn't do them. But I always noticed when he didn't do them, and I always corrected him. And what they all had in common is that if they didn't happen, there was some major annoyance for me. Like he's supposed to open the car door is supposed to be unlocked before I get to the car. And if I hit the car and the door is unlocked, I'm like, wait a minute, why is my door unlocked? He always notices that. Things like that, you know. He's supposed to come find me as soon as he comes from work, and I'll hear the car pull in, and I'll hear the door slam, and I'm counting off the seconds before he's there kneeling at my feet. And so I realized that really it was the annoyance factor that allowed me to do this. And so I started putting in new protocols in place with that in mind, things where I would be actively inconvenienced if it didn't happen. And that way, I would remember, I would notice, and I would say something. And we did eventually figure out ways to make some habits. But I don't form habits easily. So this was a good way for me to be able to give him protocols that actually meant something to me and not get sucked into that awful pattern.
And did you find that as time passed that you streamlined and eliminated many of the protocols that you had and found the ones that were really truly important.
But that's a work of a couple of years to go through and figure out. Now when we put in a new protocol, we try to get at it with an experimental headspace, and we don't get too invested in it. And we say, we're going to see if this works out. And if it doesn't, it's no big deal.
Mm-hmm. That's actually the biggest change that I've seen in the way we come at different behaviors that he wants me to do, is that we do come at it much more lightly now. There's so much less feeling of, if this doesn't go well, it means our relationship is doomed. You know, that if I was a good slave, I would be able to do this perfectly. That we're much, much less invested in any one behavior happening than we were early on.
And I think that's because we have a collection of things that work now. And we know that if something doesn't work, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah, a little trial and error sometimes. You use the term psychological protocol. I just love that term. Can you give an example of a psychological protocol?
An example, if you want to hark back to the issue of attitude, one could have like a series of like little mantras that one could give to a slave, to a suffer slave, when they're facing down the horrible thing they don't want to do, and that they really have a bad attitude about. They're like, oh no, not that thing. And like the first mantra could be something like, okay, master wants this. Master or mistress wants this. It will make them happy. I want to please them. I am pleasing them. And so just that sort of displeases them. And if that doesn't work, then the next one could be, well, at least I'm going to do a good job of this. So it could be like a job well done thing. And if that doesn't work, you could resort to, wow, this is so not what I wanted to do. Boy, am I a slave.
I sometimes do that last one. Or rather, I think the way that I usually come at it is telling him, you know, it's a damn good thing I'm your slave, or I tell you to go fuck yourself right now over this. To which I say, it's a damn good thing. But seriously, a psychological protocol is when you can't be there, when you, the master, cannot be there, having the slave or sub have these things that they run through in their head, that they know what to do, that they know what they're expected to do, that will help them, help their head be in a good place and help them to keep doing their job properly. That's what it's about.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I can personally relate, yes. Another point that I always find interesting is the inability to accept service for either side of the slash, the inability to accept service. Can you talk about that a little bit? I know I've seen that firsthand quite a few times lately, and I'm curious.
Oh, boy, the universe gave me a big 2x4 to the head over that one.
It was very hard for Raven to accept service
in the beginning
of the relationship. It still, in certain areas, has been hard our whole relationship for him to accept service in certain things. And part of that is that he was used to being very self-sufficient, and for him to trust me to be able to do these things for him, and particularly for him to trust me enough to have me do these things off by myself without his direct supervision, that took a while of him seeing that I was reliable, that I was competent.
Yes, there's trust that the master has to earn, that the dominant has to earn for the sub, but the sub also needs to earn the dominant's trust, in that the dominant said, okay, especially for proactive service, it's like, okay, I'm going to ask you to do this, and I'm going out the door now, and I'm trusting that it'll be done the way I want when I get home, and that you won't decide that your way is better and do it that way, or you'll forget to do it, or you'll get involved in video games or online or something like that, that it will be done. And that's a huge amount of trust, and especially if you've had baggage issues with people letting you down a lot, or you've got, or you were raised to be very self-sufficient, with the idea that if I want it done right, I have to do it myself, that kind of thing. It can be really hard. And what happened to me is, at first it was difficult to accept service from Josh. He would say, I want to do this for you. And I'd be like, I don't know. Are you going to do this right? And I'd also feel like I'm the master. I'm supposed to be uber competent. And what finally happened was that I became fairly disabled from a chronic illness, and I still am. And my ability to do a lot of the things in my life plummeted, and my need to have help and to be served
skyrocketed, and I really had to get over that, or I was screwed. And Josh had to learn how to offer service in a way that did not, including really unpleasant personal services that I didn't want to have to need, but I did. He had learned to offer it in a way that made it feel like a luxury service and not like mom, you know, or not like some caretaker or something like that. He had to offer it in a way that still reified the fact that I was in charge and that he was my slave, which means we had to work out a lot of little protocols. Like if I can't buckle on my own boots in the morning.
He doesn't need to be able to buckle on his own boots. He has two boys.
You know, but that means they get down on the floor and they might as well be kissing him while they're doing it, that kind of thing. We have ways of, we've learned to put in ways that little protocols that remind us who we are.
And you know, Joshua, I'm sitting here grinning as you're telling that story. Sorry. I have a thing for boots. I'm really happy you guys came on today. This is so nice to hear your stories and hear you talk about the book Real Service. It's just fantastic. I'd like to ask Joshua some questions, if I may. Excuse me, Raven, I don't mean to be rude. You have so much to teach. I wondered if Joshua might be able to tell us just a little bit about some things a servant can do to optimize their service. From a slave's perspective, just could you possibly name a few problems that you've noticed that are common and how they might be corrected? I know this could go to a
whole other issue of optimizing service. That's a tricky one for me, right? Because I am always very concerned. I like being efficient. You know, I want everything to be optimized. And so if I see Raven doing something in a way, or he asks me to do something in a way that I don't think is efficient, I get all, you know, wound up about it. And I had to step back a little bit and say, you know what? So I'm looking to optimize my service. For what qualities am I optimizing here? You know, it's not always necessarily what's the most time-efficient kind of thing. I have learned that in a lot of circumstances where, especially about not really big deal issues, Raven would rather get it done exactly the way he asked for it than to get a better result. You know, so like if he asks me for like to cook a certain thing, and I say, well, what about this other thing? And he's like, oh yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, make that instead. He likes that because, well, he decided he really liked that other thing. However, just getting the first thing he asked for without any commentary, he loves that. And as soon as I start asking questions or offering suggestions, like, we lose that. So for me, sometimes it's like, how do I get the best result for him with the least jerking around, you know, with as smoothly and easily as I can for him? If no one's going to die if I just give him exactly what he asked for, just do it exactly that way, even if it's not the best way.
I think it's also important that the slave understand the master's priorities. Like Josh will, given his head, he will optimize for like time efficiency and energy efficiency, and he'll forget about beauty and that sort of thing, and because that's just the way he is. And I'll say, but I want it done this slower and less efficient way because it's more comfortable, or it's prettier, or we're going to take the back road, or something like that. And he's like, what? Why? And, but he has to remember that's my priority, and that my priority may differ from his. And when that happens, because I'm the master, I win.
Yes. And there's certain things where Raven's got certain longstanding habits. This is just the way he does things. And even if it's not the best way, he likes to have them done exactly that way. There's a certain route when we drive down to D.C., there's a certain route that we always take. And I think it's a terrible route, but it's the route that he always takes. It's the route that his parents used to take when they'd go to visit his grandmother. So that's the route we're going to take. And for him, that is the optimal route. The fact that there might be a little less traffic, a different route, it might be quicker to go a different route, he doesn't care. For him, the optimal route is this one that he's familiar with.
Can you briefly talk about some of the more common problems you see? I kind of think about, again, the fantasy role plays that I see in the scene all the time, and I see couples engage in this, and I just go, this is not going to work.
My first idea about service was from reading the Miss Abernathy books. Right? So that's like basically butler porn. You know? It's all of
this
high class stuff. And this is nothing that resembled my life. You know, my family did not throw dinner parties. You know, we have a barbecue maybe with some beer and some hot dogs, right? We weren't like, there weren't name cards and plate settings and too many forks and any of that shit. So for me to sort of, and I understand, I mean, I love some good butler porn. I think that can be a lot of fun if that's not your social background to sort of play around at that kind of, like, fancy stuff. But for me, that's not service. That's like role play, you know? When it's service, it's more about doing the things that they actually need done in their lives. You know, I mean, while I'm sure that Raven might find it, okay, he wouldn't even find it interesting about me, like, you know, okay, how to put it? Let me step back a second. I went to a workshop on service. It was all about cutting cigars, pairing wines with certain foods, and elaborate ways of helping people with their coat on. And docking a yacht. Oh, and docking your yacht. And I was like, my master does not have a yacht. He does not smoke cigars. This is not relevant to my life. You know, he found it really useful for me to learn how to change the oil in his truck. That was a really great service. He thought that was super. You know, that did not require any kind of, like, really fussy kind of this manners kind of thing or anything like that. It was just sort of normal life and me doing things the way he likes them. We've had, we've talked to a lot of couples where a lot of it was, how do I put it? One of the most common things we have people asking us is, how do I convince my husband to dominate me? And we're like, oh my goodness. Let me see. But one of the things is you can't convince them if they're not into it. However, if you're into service, you can certainly find things the other person enjoys. So I remember years ago we were talking to this couple, and she kept on trying to push these, like, elaborate services on him, and she would, like, you know, put on a little outfit and make him a drink on a little tray and bring it to him in this fancy way, and he just wasn't really into it. So we were talking to him, like, what would you like? So you come home from work, what's your ideal evening when you come home from work? And he was saying, you know what I'd like? I'd like the sandwich and the beer to just show up and then for her to go away for an hour so I can have some time to chill out by myself. And this was something that he didn't feel like he could ask her to do because it didn't fit the fantasy.
I think in fantasies, often there's a class thing going on that we're all supposed to aspire to service that is of a class and lifestyle that many of us are not part of. And that the other stuff is boring. It's not fun. Changing your oil in your car or doing your taxes or something like that, it's boring, and they don't want boring. They want exciting service. When stuff that I think really feeds the relationship is the boring little services.
I mean, the fun stuff is good, too. I think it's important to include some of the fun stuff, but it's like, that's like a garnish, you know? That's not the main dish.
You know, sometimes life just gets in the way of the best planned service that you could ever have. I've often seen people having to bottom to kids and bosses and daily schedules and chauffeuring and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And those are masters.
Everyone
so
bottoms
it happens to everybody.
But I think also there's some people, some masters especially, will end up bottoming to other people's protocol.
Yeah.
They read that this is the way it ought to be done. And so they're going to do it that way, even if it's not really what they would choose for themselves if they really thought about it. And that can take years to get out from under.
We were talking to this one submissive woman who was just in a tizzy because she had very, let's say, like, leather, traditional kind of protocol, kind of ways of doing things that she'd been trained in by many masters over the years. And she was with this new master, and he decided that he wanted her to walk in front of him.
Oh, I bet she lost her mind.
She had a really cute ass, and she'd wear these short little skirts, right? So he's like, I can't see you if you're behind me. I want you to walk in front. And this freaked her out. She's like, no, that's the wrong way to do it. You can't do it that way. And he's like, of course I can do it that way. I'm in charge. So it can be hard when the way that you want things isn't the way it's done in the porn, isn't the way that it's most commonly done in your community.
Well, plus you get conditioned. You know, you just expect it after a while. It's just what you do. It's sometimes difficult to make that change.
And I think it's very important to figure out what works practically for you as a couple and not what anyone else says. Figure it out yourself. You can look at other protocols, but don't bottom the people's protocols. I was on a panel for people with disabilities in MS, and me and the other occasional wheelchair-using dominant there, we both send our slaves ahead of us to get people out of the way, to tell us whether there's obstacles, this kind of thing. And we were both commenting to each other, do they give you shit for that? Yeah, they give you shit for that. And it's like, this is ridiculous. We're being practical here. And yet these silly community standards are getting in the way of us having satisfying service. If we believe them. We ignore them mostly.
Right, ignore them. Yes, definitely. You're doing what needs to be done. Gentlemen, I want to thank you for being with us tonight and for taking the time to share the insights that you offer in the book Real Service and your personal stories. It's been wonderful.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're welcome. I really appreciate it. And I hope that one day in the future we might do this again on another topic.
We'd be happy to. Okay.
Thank you, Raven. Thank you, Joshua.
You have been listening to episode 11 of the Kinky Cast. Today we heard Raven Caldara and Joshua Tenpenny talk about their book, Real Service. We want to hear from you with your comments or questions. We also want to hear your BDSM nightmares, so email us, questions@kinkycast.com, or call and leave a voicemail at 916-KINKY69. If you leave a contact number, we will try to reach you to join us on the show. Some listeners want to remain completely anonymous, so we have the Bashful tab on our webpage. Just type your message and hit send. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and Cassie, I'm Max. See you next week, when Kate Kinsey returns. Bye for now.